Good morning. So last time we talked about the Unix API for managing processes and for dealing with files. So we finished up talking about our general pattern for spawning a program, so that we fork to copy the current program, and then we, in the what is called the child process, the copy, we use execv to replace that copy with a whole new program. The standard way that POSIX chose for us to spawn new programs. And in the parent, if we want to wait for that program to complete rather than just going on doing whatever else we want to do, we use something like waitPID to actually pause the parent program while the child program executes. Talked about files. So this one interface for talking to all sorts of things, not just our regular files, but other things like pipes, like a channel to communicate with another program, network, and physical devices, keyboards, monitors, and so on. And the POSIX API for files had this array of open files, and we used an index into that array to tell the OS what we want to do. We want to read, we say, give the index into the array of open files that our current process has. And that lets us read from that file we opened earlier. We also talked about some operations for manipulating this. One most notable was dupe2, which let us assign one index to another. And this was useful for changing what index 0, 1, and 2, which we learned were special. There's our standard in, standard out, and standard error, changing what those are. And in particular, because fork copies a program, including the open files, and exec doesn't change the open files, this let us change what the input of a new program we were running was, something you'll need to do for the shell assignment. So any questions on any of this Unix API stuff? Yes?
So when we're doing pipelines in the first and last one, you're only redirecting the output or input once, like on one process. So do you make the pipe FD into array just size once? Or is it still like size two?
So when you call pipe, the question is what size array do you pass to that?
It's just on the first and last one because we're redirecting one output.
So pipe creates a pair of file descriptors, one of which is the input, one of which is the output. You can't have a pipe which only has an input, only has an output. So you always are calling it with an array of two items, and one of those is going to go to one program you want run, and one's going to go to the other because it doesn't make sense to make a program's input be its output, presumably. It's not a way commands we know to run. So any other questions about processes? Okay, any other questions about topics? So in that case, we'll move on, and if we have questions later, we'll get to it. So we talked about running processes, and let's talk about how we keep track of what programs are running. So we're going to go on to our next topic, which is we have a whole bunch of programs to run. How do we decide which ones to actually execute? And in XV6, we need to keep track of all the programs that we're running. And the way XV6 does this, it has this fixed-sized array of processes and an associated lock. So they fixed the next array. This is x v6 is decided. We only care about running whatever the constant nproc is processes. That's all we're going to keep track of. In a real OS, the strategy might not be so acceptable. And there's an associated lock. This lock is a data structure we'll learn about for keeping track of who's accessing the table of processes and preventing more than one processor from manipulating it at a time. We don't want to be changing a process to running and have some other part of the system be changing that same process to something else, to killed, for example. And that lock will be how we prevent that from happening. So the way we actually allocate one of these processes is we go through our list of processes, look for one whose state is unused, and just take that. And if we don't find one, well, then you call fork, and fork fails. Which returns an error saying, there's not enough resources, sorry. In this case, you know, we didn't run out of memory, we just ran out of entries in this table. And if we find it, we actually allocate space for that process, like the memory that the process is going to have, you know, its stack in, and so on. So there's one nit we didn't cover, which is what about the first process? So we learned about creating processes with fork, and to create a process with fork, you copy an existing process. And that obviously doesn't work at the beginning. We need to somehow bootstrap this and create the first process. And what xv6 does, it has this special routine user init, which allocates the first process. So it allocates a process table entry, that's what allocruc is, but that doesn't set it up, doesn't copy anything. And it sets that to this special initproc variable. And then it loads a hard-coded initial program. So in the kernel, they just have the assembly for this program in a global variable, rather the machine code for this program in a global variable, and they just copy it into the memory of this initial process. And what that hard-coded machine code does is it just execs a program called /init, which is just a special program that's been chosen as the first program to run. Yeah?
So what does allocproc do?
So allocproc is mostly this code. It also does a little other setup, like making the state not be unused anymore. And I think allocating a kernel stack and so on. I'm kind of fudging exactly where the setup happens. It obviously happens either in allocproc or this function in the dot, dot, dots. Yeah?
Could the kernel also choose to run a shell on init and just like from there it launches different processes?
So the question is, why are we running this special program init and not, say, a shell? Could we do that? So we could choose any program to run as our first program, and something like a shell seems like the sort of program we want to run. We don't want to run a program which just does something and exits. The init program does need to do some things that a normal program doesn't. The biggest one is that when a program exits while it has child programs, remember I told you that those programs' parents becomes PID1. Well, this program we're starting here is PID1 because it's the first program we run. And so to clean up those process table entries, we need to actually be waiting for those programs. And that's something a shell ordinarily wouldn't do. And that's something special the init program will do, is it will wait for programs which it became the parent of. So the init program that comes with xv6, it calls a shell and waits in a loop. And if the shell exits, it calls the shell again. It forks off the shell again. That's all it does. On something like Linux, your init program, there's a program called init, which generally does all the things you expect this to do when you start up the system, like it runs the thing which tells you to log in. And that's the job of that program. Other questions? And since we loaded this hard-coded code, the next part of the setup is like we just manually set up the registers to make sense. So we set up the stack pointer to point to the beginning of the stack, which turns out to be just at the top of the page containing this hard-coded code. And we also set the initial address to be address 0 because we know that this machine code starts at address 0. That's where main is. And then we set the program to runnable, and somehow it ends up running. So any questions about any of this? So this is our initial program setup. So with this combined with fork, we know how we start programs. So this is the special case that we need to have. Otherwise, we just use fork. So all starting programs is just copying things, which means that except for this special case, we don't need to deal with like all the other things in the struct proc. You know, we're just copying them. We don't have to actually know how to set them up initially, except this one time where we just do the simplest possible setup. So we're going to talk about, well, I've set this as runnable. How does it actually end up running? How do we decide what to run? How do we make programs actually run? We talked about sort of a mechanism for starting a program, which was a context switch, that if we know we want to run a program, we know how to switch to it. And we're going to talk about more of the policy. How do we decide what program we run when? Because now we know we can fork programs, so we have multiple processes, and we have to make a decision. What gets run? When do we run it? We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about this in terms of thread scheduling. And if we read our textbook and the parts we're talking about talks about thread scheduling. For now, each process has exactly one thread. This is what XV6 does. XV6 only supports one process per thread. And a thread is just the part of that process which gets run on the CPU. So it's the saved register values and the saved program counter. The rest of the process, like the address space, the open files, the current working directory, is not conceptually part of the thread. But for right now, we don't have a good distinction because we're dealing with just a process as a thread. Later on, we'll actually talk about having multiple threads for a process, and it will be clearer which are parts of the thread, which are parts of the process. And I talked about process control blocks, and there's this notion of something called a thread control block, and that's the parts of the process control block that are specific to a thread, and that if we had a process with multiple threads, would be different for each thread. So in XV6, we don't distinguish these two things, but in an OS that supports multiple threads, parts of this process control block would actually be a thread control block, and we'd have a list of them. And so the notion is that in our single-threaded process, we have stuff which is shared for the part of the process, like the files, its PID. We have data in memory, which is part of the process, like its code and its data, like its global variables. And we have stuff that's specific to the thread, some of which is in memory, like the stack. And we have things that are on the CPU itself, like registers and the program counter. In a multi-threaded process, we just duplicate what's in this box. So we have multiple stacks in the program's memory. And this means that we can't actually put all the stacks at the top of the program's memory because there's, you can't put two things at the same place. But we have multiple stacks at different addresses and multiple sets of registers, which if we have multiple processors, might be on different processors at the same time. So questions about this idea of multi-threaded programs? And so we're going to deal with thread scheduling. And to know about when we run threads, we need to talk about the states they go through. We looked at this briefly earlier. I have two sets of names here, names that like our textbook uses and you might see more commonly, and the names that XV6 happens to use. So we have a state where we have a program being created, but it's not ready to run. This is after we call alloc proc, like in that init proc program, before we've actually like set up the stack pointer. Like, we don't want to run it yet. We better not run it yet. We have programs which are ready, or in XV6's terms, runnable. These are programs we could put on a processor, that right now we could context switch to them, and that would be OK. And when we put them on a processor, we say they are running. And that means they're actually on some processor. That their registers aren't stored in their process control block. Their registers are stored on a physical CPU. Now, there's one thing we haven't talked about much, which is that processes sometimes wait. So one example is if you call read, and you're waiting for the user to press something on the keyboard, you're waiting. In XV6, this state is called sleeping. And this is a common name, even though you probably don't think of waiting for the user to press a key as sleeping, because you might think of sleep as a call used to wait some amount of time. In XV6, they're all called sleeping. I'll try to use the word waiting for any version of this. This means that the process is waiting for some external event to happen. And finally, we have this finish state. In XV6, this is called zombie. And this is where the process is done except for being waited for, except for like sending its status to whatever run it to let it know, yes, you finished this command. So like in your shell, you want to print out the exit status of the commands you run so we can tell whether they were successful or not. And so you know to actually give the next prompt. Yes? So the question is, if you have multiple threads, we talked about having multiple stacks, are those stacks synchronized in some way? And the answer is no. If you want these multiple threads to coordinate, the way we're going to do that is we're going to do it through the data space or some other memory that is not generally not the thread stacks. So just like the registers, the thread stacks are kind of going to be independent, and there's going to be a convention that you probably don't randomly write to some other thread stack. You can, but you shouldn't. Okay. So this is the view we've seen from the XV6 process control block. There's another view we can have, which is of queues, is that we can say that we have list of threads that are waiting. So we have what's called a ready queue, and that's all the threads that are ready. And what we're going to do is we're going to take threads, threads from these queues and put them on something where they can actually do work. So we have threads in our ready queue, and those are going to get to go on to the CPU. And we're going to have some thing where we take this ready queue, also sometimes called a run queue, and decide what to take off it when the CPU is free. So we have something that's looking at the CPU, and every time the CPU is free, it looks at that ready queue, chooses something from it, takes it off. And we also have the same thing for, say, I/O devices, like we have a disk. We decide, well, all these programs want to read files from disk, which one do I let read first? And it's the same kind of decision. So XV6 doesn't actually have these queues, and that's kind of unusual. So typically an operating system will actually have something which looks like the sort of thing you might have called a queue in 2150, where you have a list. But XV6 represents the same information. So we have that process table. The ready queue in XV6 is just you iterate through the process table, ignore things which aren't listed as runnable. That's the ready queue. And IO queues, you look at processes which are sleeping, where their CHAN setting is set to a particular IO device. That's the queue, like for the disk, you just look for CHAN equals the disk. And those are the processes waiting on the disk. So in real OSs, you typically have a separate list, mainly because in a real OS, finding the next thing to run on the CPU quickly is an important thing. In XP6, they decided it's not important, so they're okay looking at all the programs running, all the programs that are on the system, even if they're not like active. In a real OS, you might have 300 processes on the system, five of which can use the CPU. You'd only like to look at the five. You don't want to look at 300. So we're going to talk today a lot about scheduling, and also next time, also the next homework. So scheduling is making the decision of what to remove from the queue. And we're going to mostly talk about the ready queue, which is when you want to remove a process and start running it. Now, there are other types of scheduling problems, and a lot of the things we're going to talk about apply to those scheduling problems. So for example, batch job scheduling. You know, so I have a supercomputer. I have these very long compute intensive jobs to run. You know, they take like tens of seconds for something simple and maybe days for something complicated. Like someone wants to run their climate simulation that takes days to run. And I want to decide which one do I run next. And this is going to be a different problem. For example, you can't easily context switch on a supercomputer. Like it's you've loaded the program. Running something else like is really time consuming, not worth doing. Unlike on in XV6, we're going to context switch all the time. IO scheduling. So if I have a network interface or a hard disk deciding what order to read and write things. These are all scheduling problems. And some of the ideas we'll have will apply to all of these, but we're going to mainly target CPU scheduling. And we're going to target CPU scheduling where programs do a lot of I.O. And we let other programs use the CPU when they do. And we're also only going to talk about a single CPU. We'll probably briefly talk about what changes when you don't do that, but we won't go into much detail about multi-CPU scheduling. So many of the ideas we'll talk about will port to other scheduling problems, particularly when we're talking about the simpler scheduling policies. But when we talk about like more complicated scheduling algorithms, these are going to be ones which are designed for this use case and which will make less sense for the other use cases. And there are other specialized things you can do for like scheduling jobs in your supercomputer, which we won't talk about. And we're going to talk about scheduling policies, which is what to remove from the queue. And let's first look at the XV6 scheduler, both to learn how it works, because we'll have a homework eventually, and also to figure out what is XV6's scheduling policy. What decision have they made about what program to run when? If there's multiple programs waiting, which one do they run? So here's XV6's scheduler. We have an infinite loop. And in this infinite loop, every iteration, we're going to switch to a thread, have that thread run for a while, and then that thread's going to switch back to the scheduler and back to this infinite loop. Note that, unlike a lot of code in the XV6 kernel, this is run with interrupts enabled, typically. The idea being that when we're running this loop, we want to actually have like timer interrupts do things. And we don't have any program to run, we actually want I.O. to happen. If a keyboard interrupt happens. We want to like wake up a program and be able to run it later. I mentioned that lock earlier. So we need to make sure we're the only one accessing the list of processes. In particular, because interrupts are enabled, we don't want an interrupt handler to accidentally access the list of processes and like try to change a process from like runnable to sleeping, or runnable to kill while we're making it run. Changing it to running. That would be very confusing and get us in a bad state. And what this does is we iterate through all the processes, finding all the runnable ones in the order they happen to be stored in the table. So that's our silly scheduling decision, that we have lots of programs to run. Which one do we run? Whichever one we get to first. And then we just keep going. And when we find one, we actually switch. So switching is that we mark it as the current program we're running. That's what the C proc equals. That's saying, on the current CPU, I'm running this program. Then we actually change address space and change the process's state to running. And we can do that because we have the lock on the process table. And then we switch to its kernel stack and actually run it. Yes?
So what's the C?
C is the current CPU. That is a, so C here is the CPU. This is same as my CPU. So if we have multiple CPUs, XP6 runs one of these on each CPU. And that's set so later, and this is about, I guess, if we're pointing out, this is to make my proc work. That's the purpose of setting that, is that make, that lets us record what the current program is so we later on we can look it up with my proc, which we need for things like finding the arguments to system calls and things like that. So we switch to the kernel thread of the process, and that thread later on is going to switch back. Remember that switch, the first time it returns to the other program, and later on, someone calls switch with the scheduler context and switches back. So the program runs when we make that call. When it's done running for a while, for example, maybe it runs and then it does I/O, or maybe it runs and then a timer interrupt happens. Whatever causes the program to stop running will switch back to the scheduler. And when it switches back, we change away from the user address space to a blank address space, basically, one with only XP6 kernel stuff, and mark the current process as not running. And note that, according to the comment, when we switch back to the scheduler, we've changed the state from running to something else. The code that calls switch is responsible for doing that before we go back to the scheduler. So presumably the state is either runnable, if, for example, we had a timer interrupt, or sleeping, if, for example, we had a read call and we're waiting for a key press. Yes?
So is the code to switch back to the scheduler in the functions for like the timer interrupt?
So the question is the code for switching back to the scheduler and things like the timer interrupt? Yes. And I'll show some examples of code that switches to and from the scheduler in a bit. So let's start with the first place we switch to the scheduler, and this is in the code which gets run for, first place we switch from the scheduler, and this is the code which gets run for the first process. So the first process, we set up, remember, a fake stack where switch gets called, so we switch to a kernel thread, and one of the first things the kernel thread does is release the process table lock. Because we lock the process table in order to change the state to running, so we switch to the new program, and whenever we switch from the scheduler, we have a lock on the process table, we have exclusive access to it, because we're changing the state of programs. So the first thing that happens when we get switched to from the scheduler is we release that lock, so other things can use the process table, and like other programs can change their state, like an interrupt can happen and change a program from waiting to runnable. But we don't do that while the scheduler is working. So let's look at a case where we switch to and back from the scheduler. So this is yield, and this is exactly the code which is called by the timer interrupt. So what that does is we acquire a lock on the process table because we're changing process states. We change our current process's state to runnable because we're not going to be running anymore. We call the scheduler, and this sketch call just wraps a switch to the scheduler thread. So the scheduler gets to run, and eventually it switches back to our program again. And when we switch back, it has the process table lock because it just changed us to runnable and changed what was running, and we release that lock. Questions about this? So the question is, where does this sketch call go? So calling sketch here goes, yes, right to switch KVM here. That just jumps to there. And eventually there's going to be a call switch that will switch back to there when we decide to run whatever yielded again, whatever program ended up calling yield. So we have another case where we do this. So when a process goes to sleep, there's a function called sleep, which just does this for no matter what thing you're waiting for. And we get a lock on the process table. Because we're changing process states, we don't want to do that while the scheduler's working, say on another processor. Then we set us as sleeping, since we were running, and remember the thing we were waiting for. Then we actually go to that scheduler infinite loop again, and the scheduler, switches back to its own address space, then iterates through the process table looking for other runnable processes. Eventually, some other part of the OS's code, like an interrupt handler, will change that sleeping state to runnable, and the scheduler will find us again and switch back to us, and we'll end up returning to here, and we'll release the process table lock and keep going, doing whatever we did before we went to sleep. Yes?
When a process is running, where does the timer interrupt get called from or set from?
Where is the timer, when a process is running?
Yeah.
Where does the timer?
Yeah, the timer interrupt that calls yield, when does that get?
So the timer is like an external device. When XV6 boots, it sets it up and says, send me a timer interrupt every X seconds. And whenever that interrupt happens, it gets called. I'm not showing something that happens with the lock. So when we acquire the process table locks, that temporarily disables interrupts, which is why we don't have to worry about a timer interrupt happening while the scheduler is running. Yes.
So in XV6, if I am the scheduler and I picked PID2 or whatever, and that was running, and then it switched back to me, but it was still runnable, does that make sense? Could I just continuously do the same process in the scheduler? Would I ever move to another?
So the question is, would the XV6 scheduler keep running the same thing over and over again? So let's say we're running PID2. So PID2, it's runnable. We switch to it. It switches back to us, it yields. Then we go to the next iteration of this loop and we increment P. So if there's another runnable program, we won't keep running it. Which gets to, what's XV6's answer to the what program do you run next policy? It's whatever's next in the list. Whenever the scheduler gets invoked, we just run whatever's next. Well, quick question for, you know, this week, is that the best answer? Yes.
When does the scheduler release the lock?
When does the scheduler release the lock? The answer is it doesn't. That whenever a scheduler switches to something, XP6's policy is that it has, that the lock is held, and if you call the scheduler, you're responsible for releasing the lock when it goes back to you. Yeah.
For multi-thread processes, do they use some kind of OS switch between threads thing, or do they rely on the program having its own?
So the question is, in a multi-threaded process, does the OS do the switching? Like, is the code I showed you what would happen for a multi-threaded process? Or is there something where the program does it itself? The answer is people have done both. Currently, the most popular solution by far, like every OS you can think of in its current version does this by default, is that the OS does it. And that we, in fact, use the same code we use for multiple normal processes for multi-threaded processes. That we just treat each thread like a separate process. That just happens to have address space that weirdly overlaps with other processes. And also the same open file table for some reason. Okay, so we want to talk about what's the best answer. So I'm going to have some simplifying assumptions for most of the things I'm talking about, just to set our context. And that's going to be that we have one program per user, one thread per program, and we're going to assume programs are independent. Obviously, none of these are true. They were perhaps more true in 1970, but probably also not true then. And that's when a lot of this was developed. And in particular, we're going to be looking at CPU scheduling, and I mentioned programs doing a lot of I/O. And our notion of what a typical program does is that a program does some computation. So it does some computation, then it starts a read, then it waits for some I/O, then it does some computation, then it starts a read, waits for some I/O, does some computation, starts a read, waits for some I/O. And this matches what we imagine on like a laptop or desktop, where, you know, the typical programs we use are like waiting for key presses, or waiting for mouse presses, or waiting for data from the network. You know, that's a lot of what they do, and they have this sort of loop where they do some I/O, wait for that to finish, keep going. And I say reads here, could be writes too, you know, but they're waiting, they do some, a little bit of computation to start some I/O and keep going. And we can consider that we're just scheduling the green parts here. We're just scheduling what are called the CPU bursts. So we have this burst of CPU, and then the program goes to sleep, then we have a burst of CPU, and the program goes to sleep. And as I pointed out earlier, this is not the only context for scheduling, but it's the main one we're going to be talking about. So we're talking about, you know, scheduling things on something like a desktop, where we have users using the system. And people have measured empirically, you know, what these sort of CPU bursts look like. So here's a measurement from 1966. This was a shared system. In 1966, computers were very expensive. So you shared your big computer with lots of people. And you often ran programs, you know, where you pressed a key, you had the terminal, one of the many terminals on the computer, like SSHing into our shared lab machines. And someone just measured amount of computation that was needed from when a command was entered until the next command prompt. Because typically on a shell, like you run ls, that does a bit of computation and I/O to like figure out what to display, displays it, and stops to you. So they measured like commands like that. How long did they actually take on this real multi-user system? These measurements are in CPU compute ticks, which on this system were about 16 milliseconds. So you can see that typically we have like 30 milliseconds of CPU. Sometimes we have things that actually take a while. 100 is like a couple seconds. And very occasionally, we have some things which take a very long time. some things which really just want to do a lot of computation. Okay, so you might say, well, this is 1966, why do we care? Programs don't look like they did in 1966, so let's look at 1990, see how things have changed. So typically, you know, the same kind of measurement. They didn't have a command prompt, but they measured the amount of time basically things were running until they weren't runnable that they used the CPU. And this was on a desktop. So typically it's like 2 to 4 milliseconds that things need to run on this desktop system. Occasionally you have like tens of seconds, but mostly it's in that sort of range. So things haven't changed that much. So typically what we're doing is we have a bunch of things that are runnable and we're going to run them for order of milliseconds. And most of the things that we're running, you know, they're going to, you know, they're responding to I/O is our intuition. So we have these short CPU bursts followed by short-ish I/O bursts, I guess short or long, short I/O bursts, or lots of waiting. Like if I just sitting at my shell figuring out what to do. So we're gonna start with a simple view of the scheduling problem. We're gonna kind of ignore the I/O burst and we're just gonna say, we have a ready queue and the ready queue has a list of things which need to run one of these CPU bursts. So we have a bunch of programs which need to run and they need to run for like a couple milliseconds each of them. So, and you know, we can imagine that we've just sampled from this distribution, that we have some number of programs which need to run for, you know, 1 to 8 milliseconds. We have a smaller number which are running for, gonna run for several seconds, and so on. We just have some random sample from this distribution in our ready queue, and we just want to run them efficiently. And for now, we're just gonna say, I just want to look at running what's currently in the queue. I'm not gonna worry about what happens when, you know, new processes arrive. Later on, we'll talk about what happens when, you know, I press a key, how do I change what's running? But for now, we're just gonna say, I'm just gonna look at what's ready now, how do I execute that? I have a bunch of things that are ready to run their little CPU bursts, and maybe one of them is like gonna run forever, because it's actually doing a lot of computation. Okay. Questions about this setup? Okay. So since we want to decide how to best schedule things, we need to have some metrics that we're going to look at, you know, different decisions we can make. And there are three main metrics I'm going to talk about. So one is response time. And the sort of intuition here is that this is from when I press a key to when I see the character on my screen. Because the idea is that, you know, we have the CPU burst because I pressed a key, the program's ready to run some computation. How long is it until it gets to do its next piece of I/O, which is showing me its response? We have throughput, which is the total amount of work I get done per second. And a big problem with throughput is going to be overhead, that if I do context switching, that's not useful work. Like if I spend all my time switching from one program to the other, yes, my CPU is fully utilized, but I didn't actually get anything useful done. And we also have fairness. Fairness like has an intuitive definition. Everyone gets the same thing. We think of one program per user, every program gets the same stuff. It has many definitions if you want to be precise about it, and they all conflict with giving us the best throughput or best response time. And they all conflict because I can come up with situations where the thing that gives us best throughput or best response time requires us to be, in some sense, unfair, that we have to favor some processes, some users over others. So for measuring response time, so what I typically mean is the time from when something becomes ready to when it becomes finished. So when it finishes whatever work it was trying to do, it stops being ready. We also sometimes talk about the waiting time, which is the amount of time it's actually not doing work. Just waiting to get on the CPU. And commonly, when we have lots of programs, we're going to measure the mean or total response time, or the mean or total waiting time, to figure out what's best. Because we have multiple programs, we just, you know, when you want to like get an average measure, there are good reasons to say maybe this isn't the right measurement. Maybe you want to measure like median, maximum, minimum, some percentile. But we'll mostly talk about the simple measure, which is like mean response time. Like, what's the average across all programs? And we can look at waiting time and response time when we're talking about means the same way. They're the same thing, as far as optimizing them is the same. I'm talking about response time with CPU bursts. So that's time to next I/O, is the way of thinking about it. If we're thinking about other contexts, response time is rather different. So like if I'm running programs on my supercomputer, response time is how long do we wait for everything to get done? That's a rather different idea, different thing, and you might have different ideas about like whether you should be measuring mean or something else. Just as a note. So throughputs. So throughput, as I said, is useful work done per unit time. And the biggest issue, the most obvious issue, is context switches. So here, I have two context switches, each of which takes 0.5 units of time. So I have 88% CPU useful utilization, because I'm spending 12% of my time just switching between programs, which is not useful work. It's not something any user asked me to do. They just wanted their program to run, don't care about any of the others. There are other considerations which makes throughput actually rather tricky to measure well. So one is that when we switch between programs, like it's not the cost of the context switch itself, like the amount of time we spend actually starting loading the registers and switching address spaces, but it's things like cold caches, like that our caches have the other program, you know, program A's data in it when we're running B, and that's going to slow things down. There's other costs, like if I have to do I/O, like if I have to read something from the disk, well, I'm going to run things slower because I didn't start that I/O soon enough, so I had the disk sit idle for a while when it could have been doing useful work. So this makes it difficult to like measure throughput in a generic way. If you have a specific application in mind, it's easy. It's like if the thing I want my system to do is calculate matrix multiplies, I just remember measure how many matrix multiplies did I do. But in an operating system, it's usually more nebulous, like what's the throughput of my web browser? In fairness, you know, as I said, it's usually intuitive. Which of these timelines is fairer? So probably the bottom one. So, and we'll have talk about formal definitions a little later. Probably the bottom one's fairer, but you might have other opinions. Maybe it depends who A and B are. Okay, so we'll start off with two trivial scheduling policies. First come, first serve, and round robin. And we'll just assume that all the programs that we're scheduling became ready at the same time, either like just simultaneously, or like while the last thing was running. And we assume we'll have them in some order in which they arrived. You can think of this, our ready queue is a linked list, and we're just using the order of that linked list. So let's start with first come, first serve. This is the simplest scheduling algorithm. And we're going to assume we have no preemption. We're just going to run a program until we can't. Simplest possible thing we can do. We're not going to do timer interrupts, yielding. Just going to run the program until it can't run anymore. So here, let's say I have program A needs 24 units of CPU time. You might think of this as milliseconds or seconds, depending on the context. We're talking about CPU bursts, like 24 milliseconds to do its next I/O. B is for CS3. So you can think of A as kind of like, it's a compute-bound program, a program that needs to do a lot of computation. B and C probably are doing a lot of I/O, which is why they do a little bit of computation and then they wait for something. So here's our first come, first serve schedule. We run A, then B, then C. And we can evaluate sort of how long do we wait. So A waits for 0 units of time, B waits for 24, and C waits for 28, which gives us a mean waiting time of 17.3 units of time. So that's one of the metrics we were looking at. And the big one we're going to be talking about, since it's the easiest to see how the scheduling policies affect response time or waiting time. So first come, first served is rather sensitive to order. So if B and C arrive first somehow, or somehow just got on our list earlier, then you know, we have a schedule which is a lot better for mean wait time or mean response time. We make A wait longer, but it's not nearly as bad as how much we're penalizing B and C in the order where A runs first. Questions about this? So this is our simple scheduling policy, and this thing where we have this long program which makes everyone wait for a while, I'm going to call the convoy effect, that everyone's convoyed behind A, and it's waiting behind A, which is really long. So our second simple scheduling algorithm is round robin. And it's probably arguably the simplest preemptive scheduling algorithm. So we run the program until either it can't run anymore or it runs for too long. So here we have a timer interrupt. And this is basically the XV6 scheduling algorithm. We run the program for, until it runs for too long or it's done, and then we run the next program. So to implement this, we need some way of interrupting programs, like a timer interrupt, which we have in XV6, but maybe some systems don't. And we need a way of stopping programs whenever and like switching away from them, which we have in XV6, because we're just going to keep all the programs in memory. You might imagine if like you don't have enough memory for multiple programs, you want first come, first serve, not round robin. So let's look at round robin, again with varying orders. So here are schedules where I have a time quantum of 1. So I have a timer interrupt every 1 unit of time. And we can calculate the waiting time. So for A, A waits 1-2 units here, 1-2 units here, 1-2 units here, and 1 unit here for 7 units of time. B waits 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 units of time, and so on. You can also look at the response time, which is we say A was ready here, and it finished at time 31, so its response time is 31. B was ready here, it finished at time 11, so its response time is 11. Okay. And we can see that order doesn't matter very much for round robin. Yes.
So all of them are ready at time 0?
Yes. So our setup, which I believe mentioned earlier, is that we assume all the programs are ready at the same time. Obviously, that's not what really happens, and we'll talk about that later. Another way of looking at it is that, is that we're talking about the decision made assuming we actually have multiple things to run, which is the only interesting case. Because, the case where we have only one runnable program, the scheduling policy is pretty boring. Probably should run that program. Okay. So one important decision in round robin is how long is the time quantum? Like, how often do we have timer interrupts? So you could choose to have it every 2 units of time, for example, and that gives us a bit different of a schedule. But the results happen to be I must have done some math wrong here. Or nope, I didn't, okay. Gives us basically the same results, even though the details are different. So questions about how these schedules work? So something to note here that a lot of people miss with round robin is that we have program C here. It only uses 1 unit of time. And that's because it had 3 units of work to do. It already had 2 of them. It has 1 left. It's not going to use an extra unit of time doing nothing. We're going to switch away. So just because the time quantum is 2 doesn't mean programs are obliged to use the entire time. Yes? Is the waiting time for C8? That is quite possible. Yes. Yes, it is, which means that is 8, which means that this is 7. Yeah. Yes?
So if the program ends before its time quantum is done, does it reset the time quantum to kind of shift?
So the question is, if a program ends before the time quantum is done, does it reset the time quantum? Our usual notion is yes, that after C ends, we somehow hopefully set the timer interrupts to like start there. That's the usual sort of theoretical notion. That might not actually be a thing we end up doing. Like in XV6, that's not what happens. We don't actually change the timer interrupt when a program ends early. Instead, we're going to still have timer interrupts happening, you know, at the same phase they were happening. Yeah? Waiting time? Waiting time is the amount of time that the program is runnable, but not on the CPU. Okay. So wait is run in a bowl, not running. So it's the amount of time it's runnable but not running. That's wait. Okay. So round robin, we choose some time quantum Q, we set up timer interrupts to happen every that amount of time. We switch to the next process after the time quantum expires. We also switch if it stops running, because we're not just going to leave our CPU idle. And this is basically what XV6 does. So the time quantum we choose sort of chooses between the spectrum of policies. That if we set the time quantum really short, we're going to have tons of context switches. So we're going to have lower throughput. And the order in which the programs are in their queue won't matter. They're just going to run at the same speed, so it's more fair. And if we have a larger quantum, then we have fewer context switches, and it's less fair. And if you think about round robin, if we make the quantum infinitely large, the policy we get is first come, first served. Quantum is infinitely large, we never have a timer interrupt, it's first come, first served. So you can think of this kind of as a spectrum where they're all really the same, all really special cases of round robin. And the big thing with the choice in round robin is that we'd like it to be nice and fair, probably. And we'd like to have not really low throughput. And to assess throughput, we need to have some idea about the context switch overhead. And a typical context switch takes about 0.01 to 0.1 milliseconds. This is a typical measurement. This is a measurement which tries to include indirect costs like cache misses. And that's why it's such a wide range, because that depends on what you're doing. If like you're not using the cache, who cares about cache misses? And you choose the time quantum to manage this overhead. So in Linux, which doesn't quite use round robin, but similar, they choose about 0.75 to 6 milliseconds as their time quantum. And historically, you know, we've seen values on like desktop-like systems all the from like 1 to 100 milliseconds. And this is all about managing this overhead here, that we want to keep that to like a small percentage, and these choices do that. So one thing I didn't talk about was response time. So this talks about throughput, fairness, but response time, which is what I was looking in detail at, I haven't told you, well, which side is better? So let's think about that. So let's say I'm doing round robin. And let's say I have no context switch overhead, so I don't have to worry about wasting time switching between programs. You know, I can make my time quantum infinitely small and it's fine. So let's say I decrease my time quantum. What will that do to my average response time? Will it decrease or stay the same? Increase or stay the same? Any of them? Something else I didn't simply write down? Think about that, check with your neighbor, see if you agree. And note that average response time means the average of all the things we're running. So some of them will finish earlier, some of them will finish later. So anyone have, who thinks they have an answer that they think is better than other answers? Wow. I mean, other better than other answers, like has an opinion, I should say, on the answer. Like, thinks they have at least a possible opinion. Okay, so not many people. Well, let's try best guesses. So whose best guess is A? Best guess is B? C? D. Okay, so we're all over the place. Anyone want to give any defense of A, B, or C? Yeah.
For A, if the time quantum was infinitely small, it'd be like if all the programs were running simultaneously, so then the response time would just be how long it takes for them to run.
Okay, yes. So, yeah, so we can increase. So for A, that's for A? So you think that would decrease? So it's a good observation that they'd all finish at essentially the same time. If we make the time quantum infinitely small, like the last 0.0001 milliseconds of work gets done for program A, then program B, so they finish at essentially the same time, So the response time is all essentially the same. And I think that's actually longer though, right? Because some of them, if we didn't have a long time quantum, one of them would finish earlier. Now they all finish at the end. You have the same amount of total time. I'll have a picture for this in a bit. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, right. Okay. So you think it's both? It depends on the distribution. Yeah. Okay. So I have some specific examples, and it turns out that, yeah, it depends on the distribution. You can construct cases for everything. So here is that intuition. So let's, we have things which take 1 unit. We change the prime quantum to half. Then we make A slower, and B takes the same amount of time. So the response to average response time, the average of A and B's, increases. Questions on this? Make sense? If we have an uneven distribution with a large quantum, maybe we just run A and then B waits behind A. And if we decrease the quantum, B runs faster. So we have a lower average response time. And it can stay the same. This is the simplest way of showing it can stay the same, besides one process that also will do it. But if we go from a quantum of 10 to a quantum of 1, where we only have 1 unit of work for each program, it's exactly the same schedule. Better stay the times better stay the same. So round robin like is kind of a wash on response times. Like it can make them better, it can make them worse. Depends on the mix of programs we have. So let's talk about actually optimizing response time, since we know how to optimize throughput and fairness. And let's use our insight into orders. And we saw with first come, first serve that order mattered. That if we choose the right order, then we have a nice low response time. If we choose the wrong order, we have a really high one. Anyone can tell me, like, how would you summarize what gives us a good response time? What's about these cases which are giving us a good response time? There. Front loading the shorter ones. So an observation is we want to run the shorter things first, since you know, those can finish earlier, and that's going to have the least weighting of the other things by running the shorter things first. So our best response time is we run the shortest CPU burst first. If we want the worst possible response time, we somehow want to pessimize our performance, we run the longest CPU burst first. And an intuition is we want to race to go to sleep. We want to have things go to sleep as fast as possible. We want things not waiting to run, but sleeping as soon as possible. So now we have a reason to prioritize our programs. So we have some programs which are we want to run first. Those are the ones which are more important because they have a short CPU burst. And we have ones we want to run later, so they're less important because they're going to spend a long time. We don't want to have these short programs wait behind them. This is for optimizing response time. So I'm going to first talk about a more general tool, which we have other use cases for, which we're going to apply to this case. And this is, you know, let's say we have other policies. So here we have, you know, like shells are more important than computation. This is our notion of we want to run the short CPU burst first. We could have other important decisions, like let's say we assume that faculty's programs are more important than students, you know. So we'll have our scheduling algorithm take whatever's more important, maybe the short CPU burst, maybe the faculty programs, run them first, then run all the other ones. And this is called priority scheduling. And the basic idea is we have a queue, a list of programs to run for each priority, We choose a process from the ready queue with the highest priority that has something on it. And within each priority, we do some other scheduling algorithm. So maybe we do round robin with process A and process B because they have the same priority. So we have like sort of a hierarchy of scheduling algorithms. Or we could just ensure that every process has a unique priority so we don't have to make a decision about what do we do with things of the same priority. Okay. This idea makes sense. So this is scheduling algorithm. And I guess I'll note, we'll assume that this can be either that preemptive or not. We'll talk about that later. So let's say I have two processes. I have process A, which runs 1 unit of I/O, then 10 units of CPU, then 1 unit of I/O, then 10 units of CPU, and process Z, which runs 400 units of CPU. So how long will it take process C to complete? And one question we're going to have is, let's assume A preempts Z. That is, if A is runnable, it takes over for Z. That we're going to implement priority in a way where if A becomes runnable, it finishes its I/O, we're going to run it right away rather than letting Z run, which is typically what we do, but maybe we can't do that if we can't context switch, for example. So any ideas? How long will process C take to complete on this system? Yeah?
Is it 4,000 times 11?
4,000 times 11, you say?
It's 4,000.
Yeah. Okay. So you're saying 4,000 times 11, and that's because we run Z, then we run A, then we run Z, then we run A, and so on. This is what ends up happening. And that because we have this policy that A preempts C, that we're doing preemption, that when A is runnable, it just stops C from running, even though Z could keep running for a long time, and Z takes a while to run. Yeah?
Wouldn't it be 4,000 times 11 minus 10? Because after the last unit of I/O.
We'll say approximately, yeah. I didn't talk about what happens in the beginning. Like, where do we start? Like, is A doing its I/O? Is A running? Didn't talk about that. So how about this case? We have A, B, which is another thing like A, but it's at the second highest priority, and then Z. How long does C take to run on this system? Any answers? Yeah.
Would you ever switch to Z? Would you not just switch back and forth between A and B?
So your question is, wouldn't we just switch back and forth between A and B? Yes. Z will never complete. So programs get starved, is the term, of resources. And this is a big reason why fairness was a concern I had earlier on. Because when we optimize response time, we're going to run into this issue. That, if we aren't careful, we're going to end up never running some programs. And that's not very nice. So as a preview, and where we'll pick up next time, our way of minimizing response time is going to be scheduling the shortest job first. We're going to have to do some special stuff to deal with preemption. What if a program becomes runnable while we're running something else? And we'll talk about that next time, that the obvious solution doesn't quite work.